So I'm here at Dirt Time 2012 in the hills above Santa Barbara, and I'm in the Ektwa camp of Al Cornell, and Mike, what's the last name?
Michael Campbell.
Michael Campbell. And before we get started, one of their students walked by, Ashley. What's your last name, Ashley?
Jarmack.
Ashley Jarmack. And did you make fire with either of these fellows tonight?
I did, as a matter of fact.
Okay, so come over here. Tell us how you made fire. They did a whole seminar on all of the ways to make fire, modern and primitive, but mostly what we'd call primitive. And what did you do when you came to the camp?
Well, before I came to the camp, I have tried both hand drill and bow drill being my favorite. And today I tried strap drill, which I had never seen or heard of.
Okay, I want you to describe the strap drill. I know these guys can do it well, but in your words, since it was your first exposure to it, how would you describe the strap drill?
Well, instead of holding a rock or a bone in your hand like you would with a bow drill, you actually hold a piece of wood in your mouth.
And how'd you like holding a piece of wood in your mouth?
Well, it made my mouth vibrate, and it was kind of interesting. I'm kind of used to that, seeing as I play wind instruments,
okay.
But it was kind of right on my teeth, so it felt a little interesting.
Uh-huh. And then did you actually get the fire or get the coal?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, good, good. How long did it take you?
Not very long. I got it pretty quickly. I got it on my first try pretty quickly.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Thanks a lot, Ashley.
Thank you.
Was Ashley as good as Cody Lundin, for example?
She was very good. She popped an ember very quickly. There's a lot of technique with this method. It's an Inuit method, primarily by Inuits that were caribou hunters, and they would carry this fire kit on their chests under their caribou clothing, when you need fire in that type of climate, you need it quickly, and she did it very quickly.
Yeah.
She got it as fast today as any student I had today.
Yeah.
Yeah. First shot, she got it.
Is that right?
Yes.
So that's good, Ashley.
Yes, very good.
I actually, you know, learned from you last year, and it kind of rattles my teeth, so it's not my preferred method. But I noticed both you and Michael wear your little mouthpiece mm-hmm. as an ornament. And would you say that this is one of your preferred methods?
Yes, it is. For me, it is the whole fire kit fits in my cargo pants.
Yeah.
And I wear the mouthpiece under my shirt, and that keeps the mouthpiece sanitary also.
Yeah.
And it's almost the only way I'll start a fire when I'm out camping or on long-distance hiking.
Really?
I can kneel down and knock out an ember almost as fast as you can with a match.
Yeah, interesting.
And everything's right there. I don't even have to open my pack and dig anything out. I need a fire, I've got it right away. And it's a very, very efficient method.
I was asking earlier when you did it, why does it have to be so small? And you said it's because it's compact. But just for the sake of people who don't know what we're talking about, you stick a bit in your mouth, and then you have a little drill, and you lean over the hearth. Then you have a cord that you go to the right, to the left, to the right, and you're controlling the drill with your mouth.
Yes, you have the cord wrapped around the drill, which makes it rotate when you pull it back and forth. Keep constant tension on both hands, and the string, because it's wrapped around a couple times, will kind of ride up and down the drill, is what you want, and it will, by rotation, develop a powder by friction and heat by friction and give you an ember in 15, 20 seconds.
Yeah. And is it one of your favorite methods, Michael?
It is. The only way I start fires in my wood shop in the wintertime.
Really?
I don't use matches. I use the Inuit fire drill.
And I noticed that, okay, that's interesting. I actually thought he was going to tell me something else. But when you do the bow and drill, you have a unique take. You don't worry about all the tying up that a lot of guys do. Why don't you describe what you do?
Well, the bow drill is really simple. It is one of the methods that needs more pieces to it, because you have to have a bow, you have to have a bearing block, and obviously a hearth board, and a string on your bow.
Okay.
So it's very... needs a lot of tools,
right.
Which is why I don't use it exclusively, but it's the easiest one for me to teach to other people.
Right, I would have to agree. It probably is the easiest to teach. It's bigger, but it really doesn't have any more parts than the Inuit. What is it? The Arctic strap.
Arctic
it's called.
Strap drill, yes. You don't have a bow. There's no bow with
well,
the strap.
Well, okay, you don't have a bow. You have the cord.
I have the cord, which wraps. And I know this is not video, but. There's my strap drill kit.
Michael's pulling out a little, it's, what is it, 5 inches long, and looks like there's two pieces and a cord wrapped around it. and the actual bit, which would be the bearing block for the bone drill, is around his neck.
It's around my neck.
Yeah, I mean, it is really clever. I still carry mine with me. I just don't use it as often. I think if I got over the thing in the mouth and just did it more, I would enjoy it more.
Well, I actually wear dentures, and it doesn't hinder me a single bit.
It doesn't bother the dentures?
Not a bit, no.
Interesting. I have a cap in one of the front teeth, and I guess I worry about it popping out maybe.
If you're doing this correctly, you actually have the bearing in the back of your mouth, on your molars or behind your canines.
Yeah. Yeah, he's biting down on it, yeah. Yeah, that's very interesting. So, Al, maybe you could, I want to hear a little bit about your guys' background, but maybe you could give us a rundown of what you fellows taught everybody today at Dirt Time when you were in front of the group. Because it was basically a formal class, and then people could come to their camp and learn the hands-on skill. But give us a rundown of what you guys teach.
I'd like Michael to chime in if I miss something. But we started right out giving them who we are and where we come from, what we do. And a lot of what we do comes from the fact that we're out saving lives. We're in a search and rescue unit. We're in a rapid response team. We have up to 30 operations a year. And so these skills relate to what we're doing out there.
And this is in Arizona?
This is in the mountains of Arizona,
yeah. And
where deaths occur from hypothermia or from heat exhaustion, depending on the weather. And they can be very quick, these deaths, so we have to be out there in a hurry. And we practice these skills along with the search and rescue skills. In the search and rescue requirements, we practice these skills also. We call it recreational survival. We actually go out on some of our searches, and we'll rescue people, and we'll get a call from the deputy, hunker down till the morning, it's too dangerous to walk them out. We'll start a fire with a strap drill or a hand drill or something and just use all that stuff as background. We can do it with matches. But
so you carry your conventional gear.
We both carry Bic lighters, but very seldom use them.
Yeah, yeah.
But if we need a fire in a hurry and conditions are not optimum, we will pull out the Bic.
Right, so I imagine you guys on search and rescue are going to have several ways to make a fire.
Oh, yeah.
But this is sort of how we approached the briefing today. Told them all who we were, why we know each other.
And you met each other through search and rescue?
Yes. Yeah. About 8 years ago, Michael joined the unit. I was already there. And we really kind of struck a friendship because of our interest in these kind of things, too, besides just going out and helping people. And we started out today with a view from anthropology. What were the methods used prehistorically? And we started with the basic hand drill, which is universal. You just spin a rod in your hands into another piece of wood, and you just spin it until you develop an ember. You develop powder. Powder gets hot, reaches sustained smolder, and then all of a sudden you have an ember like a cigarette. So we demonstrated that to everybody and explained where it was used. Then we did, Michael did the bow drill, which is a late adaptation, but it's prehistoric.
Yeah.
Aztecs used it, ancient Egyptians used it, a variety of other cultures used it. Then from there we demoed the Arctic, subarctic strap drill, which is used from Siberia all the way to Greenland, and the maritime and non-maritime cultures all use it in at least middle Canada all the way up to the top.
It was far more widespread than I imagined.
Yes, greatly widespread. Probably if you looked at all the cultures up there, and you're talking about literally hundreds of cultures, there's 17 Inuit groups, there's 26 Athabascan groups, just an example, plus all the other cultures and their subgroups. Yes, this is probably the most widely used of all the methods. And then the Arctic, subarctic is the only place in the world it's been documented that those cultures all had two methods.
Two methods.
And when you look at their environment, you can see why. And the other method, it could be bow drill. Very often it was the use of iron pyrites, striking iron pyrites for sparks into bird down or into a fungus of some type, and getting an ember through that form. Then we did that demonstration of that also, because it was also very European, 25,000 years ago, Magdalenian Europe.
I'd like you to describe that, because sometimes people say you can hit two rocks together, and for a long time I said, no, you don't, because you don't like hit two flints together, but you had some kind of a metallic ore, and tell us what it was called and where it's found.
Well, it's an iron sulfide, or iron pyrite, and in its form, as a rhomboidal concretion, it's formed rather than the square pieces of iron pyrite we get in Arizona. These are formed as balls, like softballs.
What'd you say?
Fool's gold. Iron pyrite in Arizona is called fool's gold.
Oh, that's
because
right.
It's very shiny, bright and shiny, and looks like gold.
People think it's gold,
yeah.
Right.
Marcasite is formed in balls from the size of golf balls to big softballs. You crack them open, and the inside is a silver color. If you left that left that out in the open, especially in your weather here, it would turn gold. The sulfide, it will turn gold.
But anyway, marcasite in the wild is, where would somebody find that?
Well, in the form that we were using it, pretty much you have to go where you find large chunks of it, and that's up in Alaska, Point Barrow near there. They have large concretions of it. It's all over places in Europe, France, Romania especially, have these concretions.
I see. So in and Europe, so but not so much in the Americas, then.
No. Yeah. There are some forms of iron sulfide that come in that silver color. They have what they call sand dollar marcasite in Michigan in that area, but it does not serve well for this purpose. You go to strike it and it shatters because it's too thin. It's a thin sand dollar shaped objects.
I see.
And then these Point Barrow spheroids of marcasite, which is, by the way, 47% iron, 53% sulfur. It's more sulfur than iron.
That's interesting.
By volume.
Yeah.
It was traded all over prehistoric North America, from Siberia all the way over to Greenland and all the way down into New England. An early culture that died out by the 1800s, the Beotucs, had marcasite that they had traded northern tribes for.
And for fire purposes, right?
For fire purposes only.
Yeah.
Yes, but it's an iron sulfide. You strike it with a very hard, sharp rock, and in our case, chert, a non-crystalline silicate, is a very hard, a nice, sharp, striking blow, and it pulls sparks off of it, just like a flint and steel that you've seen done.
But we couldn't see it, right?
Not in the daytime, because the sparks are too dull. If I struck one now, you'd see red sparks come off.
Right, because we're sitting out here around the campfire, and it's black out,
In fact, years ago, we did a demo in a campsite like this, and somebody filmed it for, I think, YouTube. And we all the lights went out, and then we struck, and you could see all these beautiful red sparks.
Wow.
It was beautiful.
So you were using marcasite and then a piece of
and
chert.
A piece of chert from Arizona, just striking it. Chert's very hard. It's kind of like our flint. If you're in Europe, the European cultures that used it prehistorically, like the prehistoric Celtics, used a flint with their marcasite.
Yeah.
And they find these iron sulfide or marcasite kits, fire kits, in graves going back at least 22,000 years.
Really?
Yes.
Really? And
yes,
what did they use
documented.
For their, what did they use for their tinder?
Oh, okay. You have two things. First, you need something to take the spark and expand it.
Okay.
And their preference over there were varieties of fungi.
Okay.
One is Inonotus ublicus, which is a is on dead birch trees, and it looks like the
what bear. Is that again? The Latin, was that the Latin name?
Yes.
Say
yes.
It again.
Inonotus ublicus.
Okay.
And it just like a chunk of fungus on a tree that's black, and you pull it off about the size of almost two hands. Pull it off, break it open, and the inside is golden color. It'll catch a spark off of just about anything.
It's very punky.
Very good, and you can grind it into powder.
Okay.
It's a very good spark catcher. The other is Fomes fomentarius. That's another.
I know that one.
And that grows here in the States. It's very, very prevalent in Europe. In France, some of them are the size of pie plates. And in fact, Romania, they make things out of it, like hats and purses, out of the what they call amadou. They work the area under the cap of the fungus. They take that soft area out, and it's very golden yellow in color, and they make hats and purses and things from Romania.
It's a stiff hat?
No, kind of floppy. It's kind of soft.
Really? I've never heard
but,
of that one.
It's kind of felt-like.
But it's like felt, really?
Yeah.
Very similar to felt.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Or almost like a very well-done, thin piece of buckskin.
Yeah.
And I've harvested it in Michigan, New York, Vermont, Maine, places like that. And I just make, if it's nice and soft, I'm harvesting a really fresh fungus. I cut it open, and with my hands, I take it out, cut the pieces off, and I expand them with my fingers while it's still damp, and let it dry, and it makes very nice. It feels like really fine buckskin.
That's really something.
If they're too dry, or somebody mails me some from back there and it's already dried in the box, I cut the pieces out and I rub them on sandstone into a powder or a fuzz. Uh-huh. And that's what I used today in the demo. That was just some fuzz.
Oh, I thought that was char cloth from where I was sitting.
No, that was just fuzz from
fuzz.
One of those.
Okay, very interesting.
From that Fomens Fomentarius.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then one of you did the flint and steel. Just the, I guess that's more modern, right? The flint and steel. Would you describe that, Mike?
Yeah, we did a. Actually, what we did today was a progression from the hand drill, and everything built up on everything else. And the flint and steel was a progression from the marcasite. That you're striking a, in this case it would have been a rock with steel, with iron.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do there is you have some char cloth or other tinder.
I guess cattail maybe?
Something, anything that will catch a spark. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you strike it. This makes brighter sparks than marcasite.
Yeah, yeah. So I think I have one in my, no, I took it out of my pocket. I had one of the old traditional C-shaped.
Yeah.
Steels.
Yeah, that's what we're using
that
today.
People use. I guess I took it. I'm reaching around in my pocket. I don't feel it.
It's a high carbon steel. It has to have high carbon in it. Stainless steel will not work. Iron will not work. It needs to be a good high carbon steel.
And old files.
Old files have a lot of carbon in them. They work very well.
Yeah. So after you demonstrated that, what was your next fire method?
One of them we did is one that I learned as a young man in the military at the Navy's Jungle Survival School in the Philippines. It's called the fire saw. And although it can be used with a variety of materials, in the bamboo, in countries that were dominated by bamboo as a plant, this was their main method. I'm talking about Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, large sections of China, the Philippines, and it's just a piece of split dry bamboo, and then you take another piece of bamboo, half of a round, maybe a half a foot long to a foot long, half round. And you cut a notch in that, and you put the notch on top the other piece that you split, and you kind of saw on it.
So and one piece is split, and it stood up.
Right.
And then you've got another half, but the open end is up.
Yes.
And that's what you're sawing across the top.
Yes, and you put tinder in the open end and hold it down with a little, we call it a bridge, a little piece of material, not to crush it, but just to keep the tinder from flying away when you're moving. And then you move this notched piece on top of the flat straight piece and saw with it. And then in other words, the saw is really on the ground and you're moving the piece being sawed.
Right.
And the ember forms in that notch on the two corners. You get two embers if you do it, if you really do it right, you get two embers. If you didn't do it too right, you'll at least get an ember.
Right. And you made it look very easy. Michael, you were holding it at the end. Now, I noticed when I've tried to do it with others, that upright piece of bamboo wants to lay down. Was it difficult to hold it upright?
It is very difficult, yes.
Yeah.
Sometimes we actually put nails in the ground and hold it between nails,
okay.
Or you can put it in the crotch of a tree or something.
Yeah.
We were doing this on a tabletop so everyone could see it.
For demonstration, yeah.
Therefore,
yeah.
I had to hold it and keep the piece of the bamboo upright.
Yeah, I think it's a very challenging way to make a fire, but you made it look a little bit too easy.
Well, I practice it a lot without any help, without anyone holding it.
Yeah.
But it's a lot more effort. If somebody holds it, then that board, the bottom piece, doesn't bounce.
Right.
With nothing holding the other end, it wants to bounce a little bit, and that takes away energy and makes it a lot more difficult. But so it's nice to have something to jam the other end into, like a tree or a groove in a rock or something.
Okay, that makes sense, a tree.
Or somebody stand there with their feet, just put 8 foot on each side of it, and you there crank away on it.
Right.
The Aitas in the Philippines, which is the native group that taught us that, also kind of also known as Negritos because they are very dark skinned, very curly hair, they used to take an extra couple minutes, split another bamboo, lay a piece across the top and bottom of that end that you hold,
right,
and make it look like stabilizers on a boat or on outrigger. It's like it has outrigs, and then no one has to do anything. The guy just moves his hands fast, saws, and the end doesn't move.
Yeah.
But I don't like to take the time to do that, so for demos and teaching people, I'll just put a couple nails in the ground and stick it between some nails. And Michael has a neat idea. He carved a piece of wood with a saw and made a groove in this, lay the 90 degrees 2x4, and he's got a groove cut in it, and you just put the end in that groove, and it tilts down to where you want it, or you can put a little wedge in there if it's too big or too small for the groove.
In other words,
wedge in there, and it keeps it from moving.
Keeps the bamboo from moving.
Yes, yeah.
So that was just your own innovation.
I forgot to bring it.
Oh, I see. I didn't see that. How'd you come up with that? Just trial and error?
Just from watching Al do the fire saw and seeing what needed to be done. I'm very innovative. I'm just by my nature.
Very good with his hands.
Yeah.
He's very good with his hands.
Yeah.
And so he looked at what I was doing, and he said, you know, what'll keep that end from moving? Just take a piece of 2x4, we'll cut a little groove in it, stick the end in that groove, and it's not going to move. And
okay.
It works great.
So
put a little shim in there, depending on the size. You see the bamboos are all different sizes.
Right, right.
If it's a little too small, put a shim in there, and it'll take up the extra space.
And so the 2x4 that you're talking about is perpendicular to the...
Yes.
Okay, it's perpendicular to the bottom bamboo. Okay, that makes sense. I can picture that.
It works well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you guys did some other modern methods, too. But I guess it's worth emphasizing, you know, you had your chart out of like 100 ways why you need fire, and these guys also had samples of hand drills, different woods that you've tried,
right.
Samples of hearths, all the different kind of woods. We haven't even addressed that, but, you know, this is, first off, that chart was very impressive. Do you remember some of the reasons for making fire?
Oh, sure.
In other words, the reasons
that were on the chart, of course, were... Why did prehistoric people need fire?
Why was it essential?
Yeah. And from just basic protection, animals...
By the way, who's that barking there?
That's Amy. That's my dog.
That's Amy. Amy sees something in the darkness. That's good Amy.
I thought maybe she didn't like my answer.
No, I think somebody was wandering over there.
Just off the top of my head, right off the bat, fire was initially a protector.
Yeah.
Fire kept animals away from humans.
Yeah.
Fire allowed our pre-humans to come out of trees and sleep on the ground and sleep in groups because animals will not go, large animals, small animals, stay away from fire. So once they could capture fire in the forest, whether it's a lightning strike or forest fire or whatever, they would capture it and then camp with it. And that type of camping goes back probably millions of years.
Yeah.
They found hearths over 1 million years old in Africa.
Really?
Clearly were fire hearths.
Wow.
Clearly were fire hearths. But did they start the fire? Did they capture it? That's the unknown. But they did use fire. Homo erectus used fire on a regular basis. And then, of course, from there you get into cooking. And the use of fire for cooking opened a large wealth of plants that you couldn't eat before because of the toxins or they were too hard. They're too difficult to eat, and then you soften them with fire, remove the toxins with fire.
It's hard to imagine life without fire.
Yeah.
Think about it, right? It's hard to imagine that.
Just think about chewing a piece of meat.
Yeah.
Chew a piece of raw meat, take 2 ounces of raw elk and chew it, and then cook 2 ounces of raw elk and eat it. And the amount of time it takes to eat raw meat compared to cooked meat is just stunning.
Not to mention
how efficient
digestibility and assimilability of the whole thing.
Yes, that's the next thing. You assimilate the foods cooked much better.
Yeah,
much better.
Yeah.
And then it's used for a variety of reasons depending on where you are. It's used for hunting, for trapping or moving game into an area.
Did you mention water purification?
It probably wasn't used in those days for
that. Okay, you're going way back to the old days.
Prehistorically, yeah.
Yeah.
Descenting before a hunt. Preparing your foods after a hunt.
Yeah.
What you didn't eat, you cooked and dried, so you would last a lot longer. It didn't spoil right away. It would last for days. And then you got into smoking meats, and then things lasted even longer. As you come down through time, it was the basis for pottery. The basis for the original metallurgy, we have the taking copper ingots and making copper tools, for example.
I mean, you could almost argue it's like one of the foundations of civilization.
Well, I say
fire.
It is a foundation because once fire started as an evening event, now you have the development of the camp mentality. People all coming together at night at the campfire. They don't have to go sleep in trees and things. They all come together. And then all of a sudden you have the development of language.
Mm-hmm.
They eat together and now they start to develop concepts.
And develop the language. They start to socialize.
Start to socialize around the fire.
Caveman and what
TV.
It does is I say fire actually develops man. Fire humanizes man into a social animal where they hunt together, they move together, they survive together. In much more efficient fashion than do animals.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know that when I got started in a lot of the survival skills, my thing was plants. But it was real obvious that when you're going out on backpacking trips, fire was essential, you know. And back then, we didn't, I guess we did have the original, not Bic lighters maybe, but we had your cigarette lighters.
And
I don't think Zippos were even out back then when I was first back. When did they come out?
Well, we had them, when I was a kid in high school, I can remember some of my friends had Zippos.
We had Zippos during World War II, for sure.
Oh, you did? Okay, yeah. I didn't know that. So I used to just cover matches in plastic and, you know, try to do everything in tinfoil. Mm-hmm. But it was obvious that that was, like, really, really essential. If you could make a fire, you could do just about anything.
But you touch on something that people don't realize when they look at their world. You think a lot about hunting and what you can get from an animal in terms of useful bones and the hides and all of that, and being able to make tools out of stone and tracking and a variety of other skills.
Yeah.
But 75% of the world prehistorically was plants. 75% of your survival in the world was plants.
Meaning for their diet?
Yes, for everything. You had to know what was poisonous. You had to know what you could use for tools.
Okay.
You had to know what you cook and eat. You had to know what you could make. Just all the medicines.
Okay.
What those plants.
I'm just thinking.
It's pretty hard to find animal material that's helpful for medicines, for example.
I see.
But the whole medicine world is a plant world.
Yeah.
And it's. I'm very safe in quoting Morris Kachansky, a really good survivalist in Canada, when I say 75% of a prehistoric person's world. In his mind, in his memory, what he knew was based on the plant world.
Interesting.
Shows you how important that is.
Well, that would even apply then to your fire skills today, because we were teaching people about mugwort and mule fat
and
willow.
All the woods we're using.
Yeah, yeah.
You didn't see, you saw one piece of metal on all of those charts, and that was that piece of marcasite.
That's
on one chart.
That's right.
Everything else for all the different roots, all the different plants, all the different weeds and bushes, the fungus, all the things we use for ember extenders. Oh, yeah. The fire is dominated by the plant world.
Now, who put those charts together? You guys did?
I did. Yes.
You put them together?
So I did I was asked to go and do 10 days of fire demos at the Smithsonian in 2005. And they paid me an honorarium and paid my way back there and my hotel bills and all that stuff. So I made those charts for that presentation.
Who were you presenting the information to?
Just people that were coming to an event back there called the Folklife Festival. And they would come to the mall in front of the Natural History Museum, and I would just do demos of all the American methods, which are the hand drill, which is universal in the Americas, the bow drill, which is late prehistory, the strap drill, which is Arctic, subarctic, and of course the marcasite. And I just did that every day for 10 days in front of the Natural History Museum. And
that would have been a fun gig, actually, making fire all day.
My car driving back there. I looked like a plant museum. It was just filled with sticks and boards and tinders and stuff like that. And
was it a one-time presentation each day, or did you just do it all day long?
All day
so
long.
So as people came, you walked them through it,
and they would say, "What are you doing there?" Or I would just finish doing a demo, and some woman would run up and, "I missed it. Do it again." And so I'd start another group, and I would talk. I'd give them a talk about 15 minutes. Of the anthropology of fire, and how it influenced our development, and here are the methods that influence the development and our safety and our future in what is today North America, and South America too. These methods were American, North and South.
So
we didn't have other methods like the fire plows, Polynesian, the fire saw being Australian and the bamboo countries. The fire thong, Borneo, New Guinea. We had none of those methods. They were all those four that I talked about.
Yeah, I noticed today you guys didn't discuss the fire piston. What do you think of the piston?
Well, I'll start the answer by saying, ask Michael, because he makes the fire piston.
Oh, is that right?
And
you
I
make
have
them.
One that it works really well, and he made it.
Okay, so but you guys didn't talk about them today.
We didn't talk about it because it is not really prevalent. However, at one time, it was going to be the way to start fires in Europe until matches were discovered.
Until matches were discovered in the early 1800s or so?
Exactly.
And then 1824.
1824, okay.
Yeah, I know that by a man named, his last name was Williams, developed the match. And like Michael was saying, it was starting to become the rage of Europe, the fire piston. We actually made fire by compression, like a diesel engine. And it had come over from the East Indies, where they were making them out of bamboo and out of buffalo horn, these fire pistons. And they came into Europe, and then, his name was Walker. And Walker invented the match in 1824, and then the fire piston just lost out.
Well, because it's easier to strike a match.
Yes. Yes.
Well, so what do you make exactly, Michael?
The fire pistons that I have made, I'm not in the business of making fire pistons. I'm just playing around.
Just making them, yeah.
I have made two out of seamless stainless steel pipe. It's the cylinder, and I cap the end with a copper cap, so it's airtight.
Stainless steel. It's a solid stainless steel rod.
Stainless steel tube, hollow tube.
Stainless steel hollow tube. Okay.
Capped with a copper rod on one end,
okay.
The other end is open.
Okay.
And then I have a close-fitting aluminum rod that has a groove around it for a rubber O-ring.
Okay.
And generates a airtight seal. And if you push on it, the compression will actually spring it in your hand. It's like a spring.
I've never heard of one made of metal. I've heard of plastic, and I have wood ones.
Yeah, I've tried wooden ones, and I haven't had really good luck with the wooden ones because wood is porous,
yeah.
And it's difficult to get a good compression in.
I've gotten
wood.
A few with wood, but I don't bother with them anymore.
Right.
So
it takes a special wood, a special non-porous wood, to make a good fire piston.
Yeah, there's a guy that used to advertise in Wilderness Way, and I have a few of his pistons.
Uh-huh.
So for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, it's a like a tube in wood, and Michael did it with a metal tube, and you take something that fits into it tight.
Correct.
The little rod that fits into it really tight has to have a hollow tip, right? Did you put a hollow tip on yours?
What I have with mine is I cross-drilled it with a hole.
Okay.
I put the tinder in the hole. That way, when you plunge it down and pull it out, the tinder remains in this cross-drilled hole. It's not like a depression in the end of your piston where you could lose your ember.
Right, so you're whacking the rod into the hole, and the compressed oxygen...
Just the compressed air heats up.
Compressed air heats up, and it ignites your tinder.
It heats up high enough to ignite the tinder.
So,
which, as Al has discovered, with various experiments, can be as low as 180 degrees.
Okay. So why didn't you show it today? You just didn't get around to it?
We were kind of constrained for time.
Okay,
Somebody let a plant walk in front of us, and
it went on
forever.
It took too long,
and
I know.
So,
yeah, I know.
No, it was a matter of time, so we picked the things we thought were the most important.
No, I would have to agree with you. I think that's kind of, in some ways, marginal. But then it's
a fun method. Yeah,
yeah, well, I liked playing with it for a while.
Method, yes.
And then you had, tell us about your little chemistry experiment.
Oh. Yeah, well, there's, you could probably come up with dozens of ways to start fire, but another way, and there was an outfitter company that used to actually sell this as a fire starter when I first moved to Arizona. They were for sale in REI in Phoenix, and it's a chemical starter. It's potassium permanganate and a little bit of glycerin, and you put maybe a quarter of a teaspoon of potassium permanganate in a tinder bundle, put a couple drops of glycerin on top of that, and the glycerin reacts to the potassium permanganate and actually ignites.
Yeah, you had a flame in, 1 minute?
Oh, I would say 15 seconds.
Oh, is that
fast
right?
Today,
yeah,
yes. Yeah. The colder the glycerin is, the longer it'll take, but it always works. It always works.
Now, somebody gave me a bottle of each once to use in one of my fire workshops.
Right.
And I think the potassium permanganate was this grayish powder.
Yeah, it's kind of really,
and I didn't know how much
black powder.
Yeah, that's right. And I filled like a ceramic cereal bowl that somebody gave me with all the powder, and I put probably an equal amount of glycerin into it.
Yeah.
And we stirred it, and nothing happened. And it was on our table where we were all sitting. And I decided, kind of as an afterthought, let me get this out of the way. So I moved it over to the stove, and it probably took 10 minutes.
We heard
the bowl crack.
Oh,
geez. And there was a big flame. Yeah, it works pretty well.
You didn't realize that you needed. You didn't realize, and you used way too much then, huh?
I guess so.
Yeah, I mean, you saw what I used. It wasn't even a quarter of a teaspoon.
Oh yeah, you used a small amount.
Put a couple drops of glycerin on it, and it lit that tinder bundle right off.
But it was a cold day when I did it, so that might have been the reason.
Yes.
But a lot of these, like MacGyverism methods, they're not really that practical in a sense, because who's carrying glycerin and potassium permanganate, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are methods that are practical that people don't think about, and they have stuff in their packs. You can take the parabola out of a flashlight, stick some tinder up through the hole of the parabola and aim it at the sun, and if you focus the sun right, it'll light that tinder.
Everybody knows what the parabola is, right?
That's the thing, that's that plastic silver stuff surrounding the bulb.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's supposed to concentrate a beam going out, but it also concentrates light coming in to the center of the where the light bulb is.
Yeah,
so you
yeah.
put a little bit of tinder there, and you can light it.
Are there other methods with the sun that you can think of offhand?
Well, of course, typical magnification.
Magnifying glass, yeah.
Well, and it can be just something thinner than a credit card, a Fresnel lens.
Just
a piece of plastic that's carved, and each curved ring outside the next, outside the next, outside the next, have a slightly different angle, and it forces all the sun to concentrate into a real thin, small dot, and it'll light up just about anything.
Where do people get a lens like that?
You can buy them in outfitter stores like Campmore, for example. We get ours online, and your plastic lens, you get a box of them. They run about $1.20 each.
Is that right? What were you going to say, Michael?
You can find them on the internet. They're actually sold basically in outdoor stores as map readers, so people with poor vision can read maps easier.
It's a magnifying glass.
It's a magnifier, exactly. It's a very thin, flat magnifying glass.
Yeah, I've actually got them at bookstores.
Bookstores,
yeah.
Same thing.
And then everybody these days carries one of these rods, a ferro rod, they call it. You guys had...
Yeah, we call it a metal match, but yes, it's ferrocerium, and you just scratch the root end of a knife across it, or a piece of hacksaw blade or something, that the smooth part, the back part of a blade, never use the teeth, and you just race it across that rod, and all these sparks come off.
Why don't you want to use the cutting edge of the blade?
Well, it's more efficient if the blade is flat. And secondly, you ruin your rod with all those gouges that the blade will make.
So, that's why I've ruined my rod.
We almost everybody in search and rescue carries those because they work wet.
Yeah.
You get out of the water,
right.
You just kind of wipe it off and strike it, and sparks come off. And we carry, all of us carry little film canisters or pill canisters with a cotton ball in it that's been impregnated with petroleum jelly.
Right.
So you get out of the water, you're all soaking wet, everything you own's wet, all your fire stuff is wet, you take that little cotton ball and it's wet, and you pull it apart and all these fine hairs are showing, and you take your metal match and strike sparks into those little fine hairs and it lights right up like a candle.
In other words,
it's wonderful.
You fluff up the cotton.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You can literally light that wet.
Now, was it you guys who were talking about hypothermia, or was that Alan Halcon today? So there was some discussion about you're cold. You guys are on a rescue. Oh, one of you were talking. You were talking now about falling into water, and you lose motor ability.
Well, you can lose fine motor skills. Yes.
Yeah.
I showed a metal match. It was too small. In other words, it was very small.
It was
very
basically
compact.
Your Boy Scout metal match.
And it looked great.
Yeah.
And I could strike sparks on it just as well as the bigger ones. But, I had a bad adventure in Idaho once where I got up in the morning and everything was soaking wet. I went to start a fire with my metal match, and I couldn't grab the metal match was too small.
When you say soaking wet,
fine motor skills
from condensation or rain?
The moisture.
Oh, so everything was wet in the morning
from precipitation.
Yeah. Okay, it was raining.
It had been raining all night and very cold in the morning, and my hands were cold and I needed a fire, and I went to start some of my cotton balls, and I couldn't grab the metal match with my fingers. I couldn't hold it.
Yeah.
So you need something a little bit larger that will work under conditions where you don't have fine motor skills.
So you recommend that block, right?
A little bit larger block. You buy them at Walmart, for $7.
The magnesium fire starter.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of that one.
And you can make a little mitt with one hand and hold the block, and make a mitt with the other and hold the striker and scrape, and you get sparks. It works great. Yeah. So it shows you some things can be too small to be really useful in bad conditions.
And then
thing about fire, it seems like when you need fire the most is when the weather conditions are the worst.
That's right.
So
that's
always remember that.
That's the way it works.
Yeah.
And then, Michael, you were demonstrating something that I thought was really interesting. I think that was you demonstrating it. You asked everybody, what happens if one hand is broken? Wasn't that Michael?
That was me.
And so and people were shouting out how they could make a fire with one hand. One guy, as a joke, said, you're a Bic lighter, right? But That wasn't what you were at getting, trying to get at.
If your Bic lighter is wet, it won't start, will it? So what you do is you
Will it not start?
It will not start.
Okay, that's good to know.
If it dries out, eventually it will start.
But yeah.
If you're cold and wet, you need a fire now.
Yeah.
So you take out your trusty cotton ball, so saturated in Vaseline, you pull it apart, expose the little fibers, take your knife, stick it in a log.
Yeah.
Put your foot behind it to support it, put your cotton ball in front of your knife, and pull your striker across the knife with one hand.
Yeah.
And spark into your cotton ball, and you can ignite it with one hand.
It seemed very simple when you did it, but I bet it took a while to practice that, right?
It's very easy. If you did it two or three times, you would be able to do it.
Yeah.
The thing of it is, most people would not think about it, which is why I show it every time, to get people to think outside of the box.
Yeah, no, I thought that was very clever. And I wanted to jump back. We forgot about this. All of your boards. Describe what some of the woods and what you this is basically from your experience.
Mm-hmm.
Some woods are better than others. You had, what, 10 or 15 woods for hand drills on your board? On your little educational board?
Yeah, hand drills. I probably had a dozen to 15 drills up there.
And you mark them, don't you?
Yeah, I had a variety to show people. Some are weeds, like horseweed. In California, you call it mare's tail. Some are bushes. Like seep willow is a bush.
We call that mule fat.
Yes, mule fat here.
Yeah.
And some are saplings of trees, like alder saplings and cottonwood saplings.
Okay.
You catch them when they're just coming up as saplings. They make wonderful drills.
Yeah. You like alder? That works well for you?
Yes, alder works well. Uh-huh.
Okay,
in fact, in a trip to Alaska, I made my strap drill sets out of green alder, and I used the roots of western hemlocks and the roots of cedars for the fireboard.
I see.
Wonderful. Yeah. And I actually used roots of hemlock and green alder up there for hand drilling, and it worked well.
So
it worked really well. But I had the boards with a series of drills from around the U.S. Like if you're up in New England, you will use goldenrod. Michigan has goldenrod.
That's not too soft?
No. Yeah, goldenrod is actually tougher than seep willow.
Really?
I
did not know that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It's a bush.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Well, I remember the goldenrod when I lived in Ohio, but I didn't know it was strong enough for...
I guess not really a bush. It's a weed, but it's very formidable, like horseweed.
Yeah.
And then I had some flowering stalks from yuccas. I had a variety of yuccas that are in the southwest. And then I had, like the tree woods that you use saplings and things like that.
Well, the ones that you chose to put on your board, were just woods that worked, right?
And they showed a spread around the United States, which I wanted to show.
I see.
Because in the Verde Valley, like I said today, there's over 24 different plants that I can use as a drill.
The Verde Valley is where you live, right?
Yeah. It's a valley, a small valley, and there's over 24 plants that I use there as drills, so it shows you. But I wanted to show a sprinkling of things. I had elderberry on there from California.
Okay.
I had goldenrod from Maine and Vermont. I had horseweed that grows from the East Coast all the way to the West Coast. Oh, cattail. There's another one. Not very popular down here, but you go up to Washington and Oregon, and the people up there that like hand drilling, a lot of them prefer cattail over everything else.
The stalk of the flower bloom?
Yes. Uh-huh.
It would seem way too light to make a hand drill.
Ours in Arizona are, but theirs up there are more formidable.
Huh.
And they actually are very happy with their cattails up there in Portland and places like that.
Uh-huh. What would you use as the hearth with a cattail?
You can use cottonwood root. All the tree roots are very, very, not all trees, but the poplars, especially cottonwood, very good. Go further back east, basswood is an excellent fireboard. It's a linden tree, really.
Linden, yeah.
Yes, and then also on one of those boards, I had not only a section dedicated to woods for hearth boards, but I had a separate section dedicated just to roots.
Okay.
Because I have a difficult time getting a fire with a piece of manzanita. But if you give me a manzanita root, I'll get you a fire.
So it's softer.
It's always less dense. Yes.
Interesting. Okay.
So I have all kinds of woods on there that people look at the roots and they're very surprised to see manzanita and juniper and things like that in the root section. It's because their roots are much more favorable for hand drilling or bow drilling than are the actual woods of the tree.
Yeah. Now, have you developed preferences? What would you say would be your favorite wood for use of the hand drill?
Good question. I think my favorites are seep willow as a drill or horseweed.
Uh-huh.
And for fireboard, bear grass, which is a southwest desert plant, bear grass flowering stock, or soap tree yucca flowering stock, which is very formidable, not like your yuccas here that are really very soft inside. Or something I discovered more recently, and that is the seed branch of palm trees.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's what
very
you had today.
Density, and I was using that today, yes.
Mm-hmm. So the seed branch of palm trees, that's so if you've ever seen a palm tree, it's that big flat stem that comes out, and all the dates are there.
Yes, exactly, And it is the lowest density part of that tree.
Yeah.
And, but it's got a lot of integrity. It's not like balsa wood, but it powders up very fine when you drill with it, has very low ignition level. And the other thing I really like are roots of cedar trees.
Roots of cedar.
Anytime I see a down cedar, if I'm driving through like Yosemite or something, I'll go look at it, and if there's a finger root the size of my thumb that's nice and dry, I'll snap it off. And it'll make a great fireboard.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And how about you, Michael? Have you developed preferences for your drills and your hearths, you know, after trying so many kind of woods?
My preferences are what I find around my locale, which is very similar to what Al said, because we live in the same area.
Yeah.
It's soap tree yucca, bear grass, and seep willow.
Seep willow, which is actually my favorite, mule fat, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I like that one too, yeah.
And that's basically all I use because it's so very abundant where I live.
That's for the drill then, right?
For the drill and the hearthboard.
Oh, okay, for both. Good, good. So,
And by the way, seep willow, or as you call mule fat, grows from California, mid to southern California, mid to southern Arizona, all the way at least to Honduras.
I didn't realize that.
I've harvested it at 6,000 feet in Mexico in the Tarahumara country and made fire with it. Oh, yes. It's a wonderful, wonderful spread.
So down into Honduras and what, Guatemala there too?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's
you can
very
find,
interesting.
Yes, yes. It's very interesting. It's a highland plant for them. But and in Mexico, it's in the highlands. But here, it's more along wet waterways. In mid to lower elevations up here, probably because of the latitude also. But wonderful plant.
So how and often do you guys get out to events like this, to Dirt Time and other events? Do you go to Rabbit Stick and Winter Count too?
Yes, we go to Rabbit Stick and we teach fire and other skills there. Michael teaches the making of the survival bracelets also that you've seen us with.
What's the survival bracelet? I don't know if I have seen it. What is it?
Survival bracelet is using parachute cord. You take it and weave it into a band and have a clasp on it.
It looks like a colorful wrist or bracelet. And how many feet of cord have you got there?
This is a piece of jewelry, and this particular one is called a king cobra weave. It's actually a cobra on top of a cobra weave.
Okay.
And there's probably between 30 and 40 feet of cord here.
So in reality, it's a decorative way to carry your cord with
exactly,
you.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
If you do need it in an emergency, you will ruin the bracelet.
Of course, yeah. I mean, you could use that for your cord to make fire.
Exactly,
And
you could use your shoelaces to make
shoelaces
your fire.
Shoelaces too, yeah. I guess I would use that before my shoelaces.
But however, if you need to rig a shelter and things like that, and all of a sudden, many, many uses of cordage.
Yeah, a lot of the native Plains Indians, their tools would be carried as decoration, and you always, you always had your stuff with you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
very good point.
Yeah. So you guys, you have other events you're going to this year?
We just came from one 2 weeks ago called Wood Smoke. It's the first year they've done that.
Okay. Where was Wood Smoke?
It was in Idaho at the base of the Teton Mountains, and Michael and I taught land navigation to that group, and survival navigation, which is a separate animal in itself.
Okay, so you're not teaching strictly fire. You've got a number of things.
Other things. I've taught cordage. I've taught southwest sandal making, using yucca leaves to make sandals. I've taught.
Now, is that the method that Paul Campbell shows in his Survival Skills of Native California book?
He does have a drawing of some sandals there.
Is that the method that you use?
One of the drawings is a method I use because it is very Sinaguan, which was the culture in our area in prehistoric times 1,000 years ago.
Yeah,
the Sinaguans are kind of a little bit like ancestral Puebloans, what used to be called Anasazi.
Okay.
And they're a little bit like the Mogollon and a little bit like the Hohokam, but they have their cultural differences.
Right.
So now they're considered prehistorically now their own culture. but they all made sandals, and the sandal style of the Sinagrans is one of those styles that Paul has in his book.
Yeah.
And also, it's very interesting, that style has been found as far as Santa Catalina Island, thousands of years old.
Yeah.
That one style that's what we call a 2-1-2 twill, you know, when they're lapping, overlapping, underlapping.
Right. That's he says you can do that sandal with four leaves, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Even though I think you could use more
leaves,
if you wanted
four
to.
Leaves per sandal.
Four long leaves per sandal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, look, guys, we're out of time, and I really appreciate you coming to Dirt Time and sharing all this knowledge, and appreciate you spending your evening with me tonight. I think I'm keeping you up past your bedtime.
Well, we appreciate the invite to this.
Yeah.
This is a very, very good event. We
yeah.
really enjoy coming here.
We very much enjoy what we do. Otherwise, we would not be doing it.
Yeah, I can see that. Okay.
We don't get paid for it, so we enjoy it.
Yeah, so folks, you should send your donations to them.
I'm just
joking. But if you want to, if anybody wanted to contact you, would they just send an email to me?
That'd be fine.
Okay. So anybody listening to this, they see my website,
mm-hmm.
and if you wanted to contact Al or Mike, and what are they doing and where are they going, drop me a line and I'll pass it along to them.
Yeah,
so
we'll answer it. And, we give out our cards to all kinds of people that later on will email us and say, I saw you at Rabbit Stick,
right.
and you demonstrated the fire saw, but I don't quite understand how you did this or did that. And
right. Well, there's
I'll
a lot of details.
Back,
yeah.
And you'd be amazed how many people I've met because of that.
And we found you here because Alan Halcon met you guys up at
Winter Count.
Was it Winter Count?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And
yeah.
I did a fire saw for him and told him some stories that went with it.
Yeah.
And he got a big kick out of it. And
yeah.
he's a very good fire maker, Al is.
He's quick,
and,
yeah.
But he liked the anthropology and the background that I had in it.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, that we could use that. So
no,
he invited me.
It was an awesome presentation. I think that was Amy saying goodnight, too, right?
That was, yes.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Good night.